The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
All the time, need the tropical vine, where they do the hula hula dance. I fell in love with a chocolate dove while learning the funny, funny dance. This poor little kid, why she never did, been loving before. So I made up my mind, I try to find the only girl I did love with.
Hello, my name is Robert Crumb, and this is my wife, Aileen. We're underground cartoonists.
On the surface, our life appears to be really quaint and charming.
Yes, doesn't it? But underneath, it's a steaming cauldron of sexual perversion, drugs, and twisted neurosis.
Now I want to share with you my appreciation for what I consider the ideal female figure. Would you step over here, please? First, let me just say, hair and skin color are completely irrelevant. She could be any race, this ideal woman of mine.
Genesis, you know, wow, it's very primitive morality. It's tribal, you know. It's, if you're going to use that for moral guidance, I think you're going to be in trouble.
Robert Crumb became famous in the mid-1960s as the pioneer of the so-called underground comic.
That risque rascal, that far-out feline, Fritz the Cat is back. He's come a long way, baby. And now he's up to his tail in outrageous adventures. In the nine lives of Fritz the Cat.
American cartoonist Robert Crumb is one of the best known and most admired of a great generation of American graphic artists from the hippie period of the 60s and 70s. His creation, Fritz the Cat, was turned into films. His Mr. Natural, a druid-like figure in white robe and beard, was a classic of that era's paradoxical belief in truth, spirituality, and crooked mischief. He was also beloved of many powerful musicians for whom he created record covers which bulged with rude energy.
This is probably one of the things I'm best known for having done. Probably like got more women interested in me than anything else I've ever done is the fact that I did this. Oh, you did the Cheap Thrills cover. Wow, cool, you know. Basically, I did it because Janis Joplin asked me to do it. And I liked her. She used to hang around. She liked comics, you know. I didn't like her music, but I did it because she asked me to, and I needed the money. I got $600.
But then, in the 90s, Robert truly dropped out, moving with his wife and collaborator Aline to a village in southern France, where they've continued to live la vie différente. I looked that up. That's alternative. Robert and his banjo moved from the American cheap suit serenaders to a whimsical French combo called Les Primitifs du Futur. Aline took up teaching yoga. And that's where they've been for more than 20 years. Robert's projects have included illustrating the Book of Genesis, no less. Aline has produced paintings and a graphic memoir. And they've never stopped drawing themselves together.
Can I slurp my tea?
That is strictly tea being slurped there. And it's being slurped by Robert and Aline Crumb, or Aline Kaminsky, but on the front of this, what one might call a strip memoir, you're called Aline Crumb. Aline, have you abandoned Kaminsky?
No, but since we're the two-headed monster in this book, you know, I don't want to drag out this long name. So, and I just sort of make fun of myself at Mrs. Crumb because some people say, "Oh, she's the wife of the famous cartoonist." That's, you know, not unusual. So, part of me likes to like give them what they want, you know.
Now, the first thing to say is that, Robert, you are instantly recognizable. I could
I
see
am?
You. I
oh
spotted you across a, across a crowded foyer. I thought,
no.
That's the man.
It's terrible. I got to change my appearance.
It's the glasses.
You already changed your appearance after Terry Zwigoff's film, and you grew a beard and you changed your hat. So what are you going to do now? Go
I
got to
change it again.
You go back to the other thing now?
I'll start dyeing my
get
hair.
Get a tan.
Get a tan, dye my hair black.
Wear but, some like hipster glasses. And...
But Aline, you're not recognizable because you're much smaller than I'd expected.
She used to be bigger.
Did you be you used to be bigger?
I used
did you?
To be fatter.
But you're very, one might say, pneumatic in these illustrations.
Well, check this out.
This is your fantasy of Aline,
she,
is it, Robert?
She trimmed down. She used to be
yeah,
bigger.
No, he doesn't like me anymore, so.
She used to be 180. But I can't tell her what, you know, how she should be.
I don't think I'm thin at all. You know, I'm very,
well, of course
but,
you don't. Of course
but
you
also, I have been teaching yoga for the last 16 years. Well, so that changes your body, whether you, you know, no matter what.
So we're incredibly lucky to have you here because you've just got off the Eurostar from France. And you've been dragged into the studio by Roger Sabin, who is a reader in popular culture at St. Martin's. Roger, place the crumbs in context for a books podcast readership who will not necessarily be into American counterculture.
It's a long story. It goes all the way back to the 1960s.
Go ahead, I want to hear this.
yeah, I'll tell you all about yourself. Yeah, and this thing called the underground comics, which were a sort of a reaction to the mainstream comics, and they were about sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and they completely transformed what people thought a comic could be. So, and Robert was at the center of that, and so was Elaine. And so from there you had, I guess Flower Power went to seed in what, the mid-70s, something like that. And after that you had Alternative Comics, another label. And they both continued cartooning and did some of their best stuff.
And now we have graphic novels.
There's a little bit of a
sneer in that, I guess, yes. What I hear.
Well, it's all like marketing strategies, you know. You can't just do what now they call comic books pamphlets. And they won't publish pamphlets anymore.
Or fanzines, which are just like self-published things. And those are like some of the most interesting things around now are what things that people publish themselves or very small publications because they don't have any restrictions or limitations. They don't expect to sell very many. And there's a lot of artists still doing great work, but it's outside the major system, you know.
So what we have here, the reason for you being here, is that you have just produced this book, as I said, Drawn Together, mm-hmm. Which collects your work over a number of years. It portrays a certain anxiety in your relationship. Aline, particularly, you're very aware that you're going to be just thought of as the wife of the famous...
Yoko Ono of Underground Comics.
Yoko Ono, I like that.
She got hate mail.
But you also have a very, it seems like quite a sort of tempestuous relationship. Robert, you say, I fluctuate between wanting to kill you and having the tenderest feelings towards you.
Is that how everybody is? I don't know any couples that don't feel like that.
I think if there's any passion, you're going to have the ups and downs. That just goes with the territory.
Yeah, and you have, you know, you're
otherwise
attracted to the opposite, but then you also hate it sometimes, you know. We've been together for over 40 years, so it's not, you know, all happy campers, happy sailors.
But this was right back at the beginning of your relationship.
Yeah, well...
And you said, Aline, if I can remind you,
okay.
I can bounce you off any time with only minimal effort.
All right, that's true. Still true.
You're still bouncing him off.
Oh, of course. And carrying him around, throwing him around, everything like that, and just, you know, really manhandling him. Anyway, but you know, when I met him, he had...
Don't wrinkle my shirt.
We kind of lived on this commune together where his ex-wife lived in the house next door with her new boyfriend... her child with Robert and the child with the new boyfriend who actually was gay afterwards. And then she got together with another guy and then he came and he was living in a trailer next to her house. And
these
I was living in a
days.
Trailer next to Robert's house. This was in 1971. And it was an incredible mess. And he had another girlfriend as well. So it was just like a disaster area completely. And everyone was always going crazy and making scenes. And people were stoned and they were just acting out all the time. So it was a very crazy period of time where... All modes of social behavior and norms had broken down in the 60s, but it hadn't been replaced by anything at all. So no one knew what to do or how to behave or what you could do or what you should do. Or it was a very confusing and chaotic time. So you have to put it in that context.
Mm. Now, going back even a bit earlier than that, Robert, you talk about that LSD changed your life.
Yes, indeed. Certainly did.
How?
It was a mystical experience. It was like the road to Damascus. Of, you know, it knocked me for a loop and changed my whole approach to my art and everything.
And do you think, so you would be a completely different artist if you hadn't taken that?
I don't know. It's hard to say, but not that I would recommend it to anyone. It was rough. It was tough. Maybe even damaging. I don't know. But it was inspirational at the same time. You can't go on working based on LSD inspiration for your whole life. So at a certain point that wound down, I had to find other sources of inspiration. And one of them was working with Aline.
Is there a sense in which you've tamed this wild man?
No, not at all.
Hey, not at all.
I've tamed the wild woman, more like it.
Yeah, that does come across in the work, doesn't it?
Maybe we tamed each other.
Yeah, I mean, I was 23 when I sort of started living with Robert, and I was really wild, and I had was full of self-hatred, and I kind of like just wanted to destroy everything in my pathway, you know. It's like a wild thing,
she
you know.
She was really,
and I didn't have any limits, you know.
She didn't.
And I don't know if I might have just burned out if I hadn't met him, but he was kind of the stabilizing factor, and I think he became like this kind father. He was a crazy sex partner, but he was also kind father in a certain way that I never had, and he kind of parented me. But then I was also like, you know, stabilizing for him. So I think in some ways, in the first part of relationship, we at least partially parented each other so that we actually both grew up.
What you can't see listening to this podcast is the lovely friendly pat on the knee, which is very unlike the sort of things they get up to in the
strips.
She has
cute knees. Sometimes I always liked about
he's
her.
He's nice to me in some of those comics.
He's very nice.
But if he's really too nice, it'll be boring. I mean,
really,
you know,
nice knees. Look at that.
Absolutely.
That was the first thing he ever said to me, by the way, when he met me at a party at his girlfriend's house. He said, "Oh, you have nice knees." And I always thought I had like these ugly fat knees, so I thought, oh my God, that's so weird. Why would someone say that? No one ever in my life ever said anything like that.
Your grandmother had nice knees.
Grab me.
Let's move on from Aline's knees to the work, but back to Roger. Talk to us about the most iconic characters that I'm sure Robert will be interested to hear what his most iconic characters are, according to a professor at St.
Well,
Martin's.
Well, he invented them. I mean, there was a character called Mr. Natural in the 60s.
Fritz the Cat.
There was Fritz the Cat.
Fritz the Cat.
Oh, and, and then myself and Aline.
That's right. He started drawing himself.
The old girl was a good character. I liked her.
That's right, yeah, a whole roster of characters. But going back to what we were saying earlier, it's odd to think that those things were being produced in kind of essentially semi-amateur publications that were pamphlets that, you know, he was selling them out of a pram in San Francisco, I think. Is that right?
In the beginning, yeah. We saw that.
And from that to the book we're discussing today, which is this lovely hardback.
Well, because there was no way to break into the conventional comic book industry with that stuff. It was just impossible. Right. I took that stuff around New York in the mid-60s, and they just didn't get it. What is this? You know, I went to Mad Magazine. I went to this one, that one. Yeah. What is this? They didn't get it.
Harvey Kurtzman got it.
Kurtzman, he kind of got it. He wanted to try and bend me a little bit more towards the conventional, and he didn't like it. After I took LSD, he didn't like what I was doing. He thought I'd lost my mind. So what does this mean? What is this about? I don't get it.
So if you were going to buy these comics, you had to go to a head shop, you know, so-called head shop, hippie shop, which would sell joss sticks,
and
you know.
Even when we first tried to get them into head shops, when I first was selling Zap comics out at Baby Carriage, we went out of the head shop and said, a comic book? We don't sell comic books here. You know, they had psychedelic posters and books about mysticism and dope paraphernalia, but they caught on. It took about 6 months. They realized it was actually, you know, by and about somebody who had done the same drugs they'd done and had the same sensibility, but just in a different form that they had. It was new.
I think that just sort of demonstrates the enormous distance to today, where you get these hardbound books in libraries and in your local Waterstones and all of that.
Yeah,
that's quite a journey.
But it's a long journey. It's been like, 40 years or something?
Yeah.
If you go to Harvard now and study American literature, you have to read my work.
It's required.
So you worked separately as well as together?
Yeah. I published work before I met him, actually, and I've been an artist since I was a child and went to art school, and I was, you know, well along in my pathway before we got together.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go on to Genesis. So this is an unexpected thing for you to do, to illustrate the book of Genesis, Robert.
So they
what
say.
Made you do that?
I don't know. I've been thinking about it for a long time. I don't know.
He's a scholarly, serious
guy. I do all this,
guy.
All of that, yeah.
Reads the Talmud. He was reading, you know, reading all this ancient stuff. And
he reads the Talmud?
He does. He's an old Jew. He really is, you know. It's like,
there is actually, in one of the late strips that you have in this, was it a couple of nasty, raunchy old things? You have a big argument about Judaism, don't you? That's
I don't remember. Tell me, what are we saying
not
there?
Not an argument, but we do discuss the Jewish thing.
And being Aline, Jewish, and Robert, you not being Jewish.
Catholic. He's Catholic.
You're Catholic.
I was,
and I was Jewish.
Grace Catholic.
We don't practice any, but we're both like, you know, I'm very typical of a Jew in my cultural inclinations and my humor and way of thinking, you know.
Her humor is very Jewish.
And he's very guilt-ridden Catholic. All those things took on him, too, so that there is that
Her
dynamic.
Heroes are like Don Rickles and Joan Rivers and people like that.
I just did a portrait of Joan Rivers, actually. I met her the last time I was in New York.
I don't know. She might not be known in England. I don't know.
No, she is. The Book of Genesis came out of a fascination with religion.
No, not well. More a fascination with the beginnings of Mesopotamian cradle of civilization, what their myths were. And I've been reading a lot about Sumer and Babylon and their myths and the comparisons with the early stuff in Genesis, and I got real interested in one of the core things in Western cultures.
Was it a surprise to you, Roger Wendt?
Yeah, I guess the extent of it, and the fact that you took so long to do it.
That surprised me, too,
actually.
That was
a huge...
I didn't think it was going to take that long. It took 4 years of solid work. I thought maybe I could do it in a year. But once I got about 30 pages into it, I realized, this is going to take me a lot longer than I thought.
Because you started redrawing stuff, because you realized you made a lot of mistakes in the beginning, because this old friend of ours said, they didn't wear stuff like that, because, and he corrected him and told him that the tents looked like modern tents. So he went back
and... That's this old Jewish guy that grew up in Morocco, and he said that, in ancient biblical times, they didn't wear bathrobes, and they didn't buy their tents at the sporting goods store.
But that's why this book is interesting, because you were producing some of these strips, which are very light, very funny, at the same time that you were doing that.
That work is like stand-up comedy in a certain way. You play back on one another.
Those strips that we do together are really easy to do compared to doing your own work by yourself.
And we take on the persona. Like, let's say, sometimes we would get sent by The New Yorker to cover, like, the Cannes Film Festival. So we'd get into this idea, okay, now we're these journalists, reporters, and we have our badges on.
And they're paying for our hotel room.
Yeah, so we're going to, like, beyond the job, so I said, all right, my job, I have to meet Harvey Weinstein. I have to do something, so I can write about
it. Meaningful or interesting.
So at least get rejected. So I went to Miramax Studios, and they said, oh, you can't meet Harvey Weinstein. Who are you? I said, I'm a reporter for The New Yorker. They said, that's a pink badge. That doesn't mean anything. You need a white badge if you want to meet Harvey Weinstein. I said, okay. So then I went back. I'm not going to get to meet him. And then somehow I got an invitation to a party, and it was the Miramax party, and he was there.
How did you wangle that?
Someone got sick, and then it was Jim Hoberman.
He didn't want to go alone,
so he invited
that's
me.
Right.
So I went, and I was everyone there was scary. It was the scariest looking group of people I have ever seen. It was like Michael Moore and the Weinstein brothers. They looked like mean refrigerators. And then they were just like the scariest, most cosmetic surgery, makeup looking people. Really scary. Everyone was scary. And I just was like standing by a palm tree, like I was paralyzed. And Harvey Weinstein came up to me and said, I know who you are. I thought, how can this be? And it's because of the Terry Zwigoff film. And he said, I just want you to tell Terry Zwigoff I'm not mad at him and we're great friends, because I think he thought I was going to say something bad about him or something like that.
Because Terry Zwigoff just had a big legal battle with him
over some film that he'd done
with Terry.
So I didn't care. That was enough for me. I had my story, and that's what I wrote about. My 2 seconds with Harvey Weinstein.
Because I said to her in the strip, and I asked her in person, why do you want to meet Harvey Weinstein? She said, I want to go to the heart of darkness.
And then he immediately shut me out after 2 seconds. That was it. I was over.
You had your 10-second meeting.
And that was it. That was over.
But this book is, apart from any other things, really rude, isn't it?
Rude and tattooed.
Mean-spirited. Painfully honest.
Not mean-spirited. That's one thing it isn't.
Oh, okay,
it's
good.
Not mean-spirited.
Well, we're completely self-deprecating, and we're totally, embarrassing.
Well, I would say at the beginning it's really rude and rough, and then it kind of gets a little bit more refined as time goes on. But then, we had this impulse to, break out of being, just old, nice people and be crude and rude.
The last story after the Bible, then we did the raunchiest story, because everyone was saying, Robert, oh, God, he's an old guy, he's drawing the Bible. I said, all right, we have to do sex, senior sex now. So we did, the longest blowjob scene we ever drew in that story, extended, graphic, disgusting. And what's more horrifying than old people having sex? It's like my daughter said, oh, my God, I thought by now you would stop embarrassing me, but it's worse than ever.
She said that?
Yeah.
Oh my
but
God.
it's not that embarrassing. I mean, it's okay.
It's okay.
Oh, thank God.
Of course, it's okay.
Thank you.
What if your parents did it, though?
Oh, yeah, well, they would be. That's, yeah.
I'm
that's,
glad you said it's
that's
okay.
different.
That makes,
but,
that's
I mean, really, you know, that's that, it's very liberating. It's very political in these conservative times, isn't it?
Yeah,
I hope so.
Yeah, I'd like to come back to your politics, actually, because actually you are serious. Underneath this, there is a seriousness, isn't it?
Dead serious. I am.
So tell us about your politics and how you represent them.
Don't even get me started. Again, how long have you got? I'm a total conspiracy theorist. I believe that we are basically, there is a conspiracy against us. It wears a nice face now. It wears a smiley face. They learned they have to do that in the modern world now, in the West anyway, in the supposed, quote, democratic West.
Follow the American election very closely and, you know, read the articles behind the lines and figure out how the PR is working in terms of, you know, getting votes. It has little to do with anything that you see on the exterior, you know, they just...
But it's always been thus, hasn't it?
Yes, but they've got it way down now. They've got it so scientifically figured out. They look at your what you buy online and they figure out everything about you, and then they just target you and they tell you what you want to hear so that they give you the candidate you want.
There are 250,000 people in public relations. That tells a lot.
And how many intellectual property lawyers? That you know, they're really, that's a whole other industry.
100,000 new ones every year are coming out of law school.
We've been censored in our work. Like, in this book, can I say this? For our New York American publisher, I had to take out the line, woke up, got out of bed, dragged a comb across my head. I had to take it out of the book.
Because it was infringement of copyright.
It should be fair use.
Blank
line in the book. Fair use is really in retreat.
And our daughter did a book, and they took out like one third of the work because she said when she was a kid she was influenced by Disney cartoons. She wasn't allowed to make any references to any of the stuff she was influenced by.
Yeah.
Along the way, you've brought up a daughter. You've had a quite a conventional family life.
You have two grandchildren.
You have your grandparents. You live in France now, so you're observing what's happening in the States from a distance.
Yeah.
Do you like France?
It's nice to be observing from a distance rather than being in the middle of it.
You have a certain detachment from it, and I think you see you have an overview because you're not bombarded every day by the thing itself, you know. And do we like France? Well, France is a good place to live if you don't have to earn a living there.
Right. If you have to earn a living from the French, it'll drive you nuts. It'll tear your hair out. But if you can make your money elsewhere, it's a great place to live.
Yeah, because they're such bad business people that they don't get very much together, so the place doesn't change that much. It doesn't get ruined. It's, like, really, really nice, especially in the South where we live. You know, they can't get anything together. So it's like it was, you know, 100 years ago.
But
and it's really nice.
Generally, they're very tacky in business. They pull all kinds of crap when you do business with them.
But they do have a very lively comic book tradition, don't they?
They do, yeah.
And have they taken to you?
Not real big time. There's a really good publisher there, excellent, impeccable publisher that publishes my stuff on a very small scale. But
and
he does
De Noël
beautiful
published Genesis
productions.
And this book.
Yeah, De Noël did Genesis, and they did the Drawn Together, which they called, what did they call it?
Parle-moi d'amour. Talk to me of love, because Drawn
Together
doesn't
work. Is that so French,
work.
Isn't it?
Yeah, well, Drawn Together, you can't find the same word play with that. But also, he was, you know, he was president of the festival in Angoulême, and he's been honored. He also pushes it away. But, you know, and in the 1970s, they had a lot of his work in Actuel, which was a very important, influential magazine
to our generation.
It was a hippie magazine
in the 70s, so a lot of people in France know my work from Actuel in the 70s.
Well, he definitely has a place there, I would say.
They like me.
You have a house, do you, in France, and do you have studios in your house, or do you sit side by side and pinch each other every now and then?
Well, if we work together, we kind of work side by side.
I work in his studio if we work together, usually.
When we work together, we have these desks facing each other, and it goes really fast with Aileen because she just, like, pours out this, like, constant stream of, like, Don Rickles, Joan Rivers humor just pouring out her all the time, and I'm just writing as fast as I can, and as an idea progresses, she gets even more inspired. We always have like five times more material than we can possibly squeeze into, you know, one or two or three pages.
When you say writing, you write it down.
I'm
do you mean
down
you're
what
drawing
she's saying.
It?
No,
writing the dialogue first.
So you write, so you do like a storybook for yourself, and then you do put the drawings
We kind of do that. It's very loose, though. And then as we actually working on condensing it down into comic book panels, other things come up, and we think, well, maybe. So it takes a lot of editing and, you know, before it actually gets inked.
I have a book with me I carry all the time, so if we have an idea, like on the train we might write an idea, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
And then we go through them and pick the ones that really will work and stuff like that, you know.
I think we need to explain to the listeners that the book, these strips are unique because they are about Robert and Aileen sharing the same story world.
That's right.
So Robert will draw himself, and Aileen will draw herself, and they have completely different styles.
Yeah, we write our own dialogue, and we kind of pass it back and forth. That's how it works.
So that's what makes this book amazing, and that's
world's only cartooning couple.
Well, you know, it's like George Burns and Gracie Allen, who are an American comedy team, vaudeville, and then TV comedy team, and, you know, we kind of think of ourselves as George and Gracie when we get into that writing mode.
Well, there is that, because you obviously, I mean, even now, like, you make each other laugh, and it seems to me that's what you do in the book.
She certainly makes me laugh all the time.
Oh, you feed me constantly. Good lines, though. And also, I can't draw hands. A lot of things I can't draw. So I say, Robert, which side is the thumb on? And then he'll show me. Right. So I really like
it. That's right.
And what are Aileen's strengths as a drawer that you don't have?
Aileen's like a primitive. So her drawings are very expressive in this primitive way, which I'm too locked into cartoon techniques and stereotypes, you know, which I can't break out of. But she's just like, she's coming from her own place. It has nothing to do with, she can't pick up techniques from other artists or older artists. I've showed her, try this, Aileen. She's just on her own thing. It's
I've heard it described as aggressively amateurish. I don't know if you take that as an insult, or, I mean, it's kind of...
That's the way it is. Like, I don't have any control over it. I'm like a German expressionist artist, you know. I've been drawing and painting since I was 8, and I did it to maintain my sanity.
You're not like a German expressionist.
I am.
Most of them are actually very trained artists. You're not. You're primitive. You're outsider.
In the sense that it's like, you know, very powerful, emotional, and raw in that way.
It's raw.
Raw. I started drawing to keep my sanity. I grew up in a suburb of New York in this totally barbarian world. I was alienated from the time I was a kid. But
I started drawing to save my sanity also, but you were not steeped in comics
kid. I was really into fine art and drawing, and just, you know, your line is your voice, and that saved me, that line. So I never tried to make it something else. I just always thought that, you know, that it is what it is. So, and I didn't read comics when I was a kid very much.
Sure, I think the mode of drawing kind of captures, I mean, you can hear that they're very different personalities, and the way they draw kind of captures their characters.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, you know, you've discussed autobiography on the podcast before, and, you know, they are performances, really. These strips are performances, and sort of, and the drawing style captures the characters that they create.
It was very interesting that I introduced it by saying that you were like a fantasy pneumatic woman, but this is your fantasy of yourself. It's not Robert's fantasy of you. As this sort of very pumped up,
comic?
Aggressive. Yeah, yeah.
It's not a fantasy of myself. I think it just is me. I don't think I hide very much because I'm not capable of it. If I could make up characters, maybe I would, but I can't.
Well, but if you look through that book, you see that you were much more pneumatic in the earlier work. Later, she becomes much more trimmed down, as she did in real life.
Yeah, when I started teaching yoga and everything, you know. And I gave up drinking alcohol too. That I kind of trimmed down after that. I gave up drinking alcohol and took up yoga. Well, you know, that's what happens to you when you're old. If you want to live to be an old granny, you got to do something, you know. So
when I first met Aileen when she was 23, and we were talking, and she told me that before she met me, she had sex with hundreds of men. And I said, really? Geez. And like, tell me about it. She says, I don't remember any, but I was drunk all the time.
Amazing that you're still around and still being so creative after all that. And I thank you very much.
I'm amazed too.
Thank you for coming in.
Yeah, it's a miracle.
Hello, world. This is the event mankind has been waiting for.
On my Persian rug, I can stray far away up to the land of my dreams. On my Persian rug, wishes to all come true, and I'm Aladdin, so it seems. Robots bring to me gifts of wealth and treasure. Slave girls sing to me love songs tender. On my Persian rug, cares of day drift away, leaving the gold of my dreams.
Robert and Aileen Crumbs, Drawn Together, is published by Knockabout. There in France, the Crumbs have found that comics known as bande dessinée are probably more popular than in the US. But we have our very own growing tradition here in the UK, and I'm very proud to say that The Observer makes proper effort to support it with the annual Observer Cape Comica graphic short story competition. It was won this year by Corbin Wilkin with his tale of a youthful friendship, But I Can't.
After school, we had our little club made up of two members and made cute attempts to receive alien signals and send messages to the stars. When we got older, Harriet converted her shed into a small observatory and began constructing this radio telescope. She used these exclusively for searching for signs of extraterrestrial life. By year 11, I'd stopped trying to stick up for her. There were loads of stupid rumours, but something that stuck was kids who saw her walking out of town at night. They'd spot her from a window of a car alone on some country road, turning into a field or some trees. Harriet went missing, which silenced all but the cruelest schoolchildren. The countryside surrounding the town was scoured, but they never found a body.
And with me now is one of the judges of the competition, and indeed its founder, Rachel Cook.
I'm not exactly sure if I'm allowed to call myself its founder, but yeah, I have been there since the beginning.
What was it that marked Wilkins' story out for you?
The thing that people always fall down on is they either do nice pictures or they do a great story, but they can't combine them in this very, very constricted space because it's only four pages. And what we liked about Corbyn's was there was a proper narrative, and there was, he actually handled time. You know, his characters, we saw them as children and then as women. And that is a really hard trick to pull off in a comic that's only four pages long. And that's really what won it for him, I think.
You also pointed out that his colour is very striking. It's sort of canary yellow, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I mean, it's not actually my cup of tea. He's very influenced by Seth, who's a cartoonist I really love. But one thing Corbyn does, which some other people don't do, I mean, we get lots of things that are done on computers and they have a certain flatness. Corbyn still uses, you know, ink and watercolour. And his colours are amazingly rich. And I knew as soon as I saw it, apart from anything else, it would look fantastic when it was in the paper. And that's always in my mind. It's not why you win, but it certainly helps me to, you know, if I can visualise how it's going to look in The Observer. You know, he's super talented. And the runner-up, actually, who I loved, which was called I, Yeti, I just thought that was beautiful. It's by Steve Tillotson, who's from Ilkley. And I think he's got such an amazing career ahead of him as an illustrator. He's just beautiful drawings. He fell down on his story, but I've told him he must enter next year, because you can always win on your fourth go.
And so Corbyn's in his early 20s.
Yes, yeah. I mean, the people that enter are usually people who've recently graduated from art school or are still at art school. We try and publicise the competition at, you know, Wimbledon and in Brighton and places like that. They're mostly young people.
And they're coming out of art school,
yes.
Not out of a writing background.
No, they never do. Very occasionally we get people who are a team, and there's a writer and an illustrator. That tends to be an art student and their pal who's not an art student, who writes the story. But mostly they seem to be people from an art background. At the award ceremony, which we had at Foyles, I chatted to, you know, a few people who'd entered. And a lot of them were saying, you know, it's a really hard time to do illustration at art college. And there's no work around when you come out. And that comics had kind of saved them because, you know, Steve Tillotson produces his own fantastic comics called Banal Pigs, which he sells at, you know, festivals and comic shops. So it gives you a kind of lifeline while you're, you know, hoping to get more work. And you can establish yourself on the internet as a comics artist in a way that you can't if you're just an illustrator. It's quite interesting, I think.
That's actually ties in so interestingly with what the Crumbs were saying about their origins way
yeah.
back in the day when actually you had to put out your own stuff and put it into
yes.
alternative bookshops because
yeah.
you couldn't afford to.
No, and that still goes on, and there's a whole culture of it, and it's actually thriving here. I mean, there are a number of sort of comics festivals, and these young guys and girls, lots of girls, which really cheers me up. That's what they do. Steve Tillotson said to me, in a way, that's how it's kept him going doing his comics, you know, because it can be so lonely being an illustrator, and especially an unemployed illustrator. So I feel, I don't know, I mean, I'm so proud of our competition for so many reasons, but that's like an extra reason to feel pleased about it, I think.
Now, back in 2007, which was the very first
yeah.
year
yeah.
of the prize, you wrote about your conversion from someone who thought graphic novels were for geeks
yes.
to being a bit of a fangirl.
Yeah.
Tell us about your evolution as a reader of these things.
I liked comics as a child. I really loved Tintin and Asterix and things like that. My brother was very into comics, but I basically, at a certain point, I decided that if you liked a comic, you were a Marillion fan. You know, you were probably a bloke, you're probably a bit sweaty, you probably lived in a bedsit and never spoke to anyone, and that world wasn't for me. And then I think, like everyone, I read these big ones. I read Mouse, and I read Persepolis, and I read Fun Home by Alison Bechdel, and I realised that you could get the same pleasure and deep satisfaction from a graphic novel as you could from a regular novel. And I love novels more than I love practically anything apart from my husband. So I realised that they were so rich, and then I just became addicted. I mean, the great thing about them is you can read them quickly. So you get the feeling that you have from a novel, but you know, when you're busy, you can fit one in. And I like that a lot. And, you know, since we started the competition in The Observer, we've made an effort to review a graphic novel every single month. When we started doing that, I was very anxious about it. I thought there won't be a one that's good enough every month, you know. And actually, it's been the opposite. I sometimes am, you know, there and I've got three books I would like to review, and there's no way I have to literally throw a coin to decide which one of the three I'm going to write about in a given month. So that's a sign of how fantastic, you know, the whole... It is a phenomenon. It's a phenomenon.
To skeptics,
yes,
who don't know how to read. I mean, we've got some examples this year. For example, Chris Ware's just brought out a new one.
Yes.
And it's a massive, great brick of a book, which would not find room in most people's little bedsits or bookshelves.
Not.
And yet some of the writing is so tiny, you can barely read it.
I know. I think if that were the first graphic novel you would ever read in your life, that might not be the one. It comes in a box. It's like a board game. There are 30 or so pamphlets and books and all things, and you can read them in any order. And I do think that that has appealed to a certain comics fan. I don't think it has an appeal just in its own right. And I would say it's pushed the boundaries, and it's fantastic to see that happening, but it's not a good starting point.
It's structured on a Chicago, three-story Chicago house, isn't it? So I actually love it. It's like moving dolls around a house, isn't it?
You could sit like that. It's all about space, and his books are always about space. And so the box replicates this tower block, and each frame you have a feeling that you're looking through a window. And it's all about people's unhappy interior lives. It's incredibly poignant and incredibly private. I mean, there are some incredibly private moments in it. You know, there's a woman using a tampon, and there's a man sort of lying in bed, and his middle-aged wife is in front of him, and he doesn't even notice her, even though she's naked, and she feels, you know, so it's all about these terribly, it's so plangent, but it is a faff, you know, you can't put it in your handbag, and you certainly can't, I'm happy to say, read it on a Kindle.
Oh, we have a little bit of Ludditism coming coming out.
Yes.
You have just been finishing off your Christmas roundup, in which you claim to have something for everybody in the whole family.
You could go to a bookshop, buy a graphic novel for every single person in your family, and know that they would be happy and not have to buy anything else. The amazing thing is that there are funny ones, there are sad ones, there are non-fiction ones. I mean, Self-Made Hero have published a fantastic memoir this year about life under Mao in China, and it's really a brilliant book. They've also published a book called The Best of Enemies, which is a history of US Middle East relations. And I think if I saw that on a regular book, I'd think, oh, that's a bit heavy. But this is a comic, and it's, you know, it's really enlightening. One of my books of the year, really, Jerusalem by Guy Delisle, the French cartoonist. He writes travel books. He's written about Burma and the past and North Korea. This book is an account of the year that he spent living in Jerusalem with his wife, who worked for the UN. And it really is the best book I've ever read about that city. It makes a very complex situation seem, you know, amazingly clear. He has this beautiful economy. He's brilliant. You know, that's non-fiction. And then there've been, I mean, I think my favourite comic ever is the Days of the Bagnold Summer by Geoff Winterhart. And he was a runner-up in our prize, and he got a publishing deal from Cape on the back of that a couple of years ago. And this is just a brilliant cartoon about a teenage boy who likes crisps and heavy metal. He has this rather sad, lonely mum, she's a single mum, and he thinks he's going off to America for the long summer holiday to stay with his dad and his new glamorous young stepmum. And then his dad cancels, and he's left at home with Sue, his librarian mum. And it's about their summer together and their inability to communicate. And it will appeal to anyone in the world, because everyone has been a teenager. Everyone remembers how horrible it is to be 15. But it will also appeal, I think, to teenagers because it's very funny about parents, and it will appeal to parents because it's very funny about, you know, having to communicate with this kind of smelly hormonal creature who's living in your spare room. And it's beautifully drawn, and it's a very inexpensive little paperback. You know, you could just give it to people for a stocking filler. It's absolutely fantastic.
Well, on that note, I think we are going to bring this podcast to an end. You can find details of all the books that Rachel's talked about on the website. And you can also see Corbin Elkins' But I Can't on guardian.co.uk/books, along with all the other stories shortlisted for the Observer Cape Comica Prize. Thanks very much to Robert and Aline Crum, Roger Sabin, and of course, Rachel. On the site too this week, there's a bonus podcast from Art Angel's Room for London. In our 10th visit to this replica of Joseph Conrad's Roi des Belges, stranded on the roof of the South Bank Centre, we hear from the Pakistani novelist Camilla Shamsi, who wonders why women so rarely get a look in on the literature of exploration when they have such a distinguished tradition of travel writing. Yet another woman issue, Rachel. Until next week, from me, Claire Armistead, and our producer, Tim Mabey. Goodbye.
My soul is tormented.
Jeez. Oh, no.
I've been up and down the four corners of this big old world.
I've seen it all. I've done it all.
Jeez.
Oh, wow.
I've fought many a good man. I've laid many a good woman. I've had riches and fame and adventure.
When he rattles his bones. Old Parson Brown dancing around like a clown. Old Aunt Jemima, past 83, shouting out full of pep. Watch your step, watch your step. One-legged Joe is dressing around on his toe. Throws down his crutch and hollers, let her go. And then it's hail, hail, the gang's all here for the Alabama Julie.
The Guardian Masterclasses are now accessible as video downloads and streams. For our podcast listeners, we have a special offer on the great science writer Tim Radford's Masterclass. Normally £3 to stream or £5 to download. We are offering 10% off, and all you have to do is use our podcast listeners discount code, ScienceSave, all one word, and check out all our Guardian Masterclasses at guardian.co.uk.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.